speaking on geometric uncertainties and individualized patient treatment.
Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. I guess James's reward for being on the scientific program for so many years was that once he came off the scientific program, he got double booked. So James is supposed to give me talks in two different rooms right now, and so I'm going to be substituting for him in this talk. Many sources of error and uncertainty factor into the final dose distribution actually realized for a patient under treatment. And I guess it should be obvious that if we know about these, it shouldn't be possible to truly contemplate optimizing planning or dose delivery without understanding the effects of patient setup errors and organ motion and including them where possible in the optimization process, or at least, as we're going to talk about here, try to make plans that are robust to those types of variations. So the objectives that we were set up for this talk were to try to understand the types of geometric uncertainties, to evaluate the methods to extract individual variations as opposed to the population, and to discuss geometric versus dosimetric compensation for those effects, and then to introduce the topic of robust planning and adaptation, which you'll hear about by three speakers that follow me. Geometric uncertainties, there are several. These list many of them. There are patient positions, tumor positions, target delineation errors, breathing motion, physiology, and heartbeat, peristalsis, things like that. All of those can affect what our definition of the patient model is and how it changes with time and even during treatment, as in many cases. Standard ones that we can have easily can think about and deal with are the patient position, that means the skeleton with respect to the isocenter primarily, or tumor position, meaning the tumor with respect to the skeleton. So the organs within in the patient and with patients in the room. And these are the things that you all know about and have heard about and we've talked about several times. The origin of these types of data are, go look. You do a trace. This is just a pattern of where the patient was in the, let's say, the superior-inferior direction as a function of time. This is if nothing was done to the patient, if we just captured the data on a portal imager, for instance, in one direction and extracted where their position of their bony landmarks were with respect to the anatomy, you get a distribution over time, and you've got the information for one patient. You can combine those data with other patients and get an idea of how your population has sets up, if there's a standard, if there's an offset in the mean position, a systematic error, or what the random error is around it. The systematic offset is generally defined as the average position over all fractions, or the fractions that you've looked at, but is approximated from a small number of measurements at the start of treatment. So if we start taking measurements in a patient and find out that we're here and this is where we would like the patient to be, either we're going to move the patient to this point or move our isocenter to this point in the patient, one way or the other. So that after adjusting for the systematic error, we have things grouped around where we hope they'd be, but we still have the random component left over. The random components of variation are determined as a spread about the average. And these are more difficult usually to estimate because it takes a lot more measurements, as we'll see, in order to determine that part for an individual patient. But they're also generally lower in magnitude than the systematic errors and can be incorporated into the dose calculations or into some other margin recipe rather easily since they're you predict them by some sort of a distribution. Now, how are these things standardly taken into place? Well, I think this many people have seen this formula for doing the PTV margin that came from the Netherlands Cancer Institute group. And it, as you notice right away, as everybody will point out, is this big number in front of the systematic error and the small multiplier that goes times the random error. And indeed, this has been shown by many places that the biggest thing that you want to get rid of is the systematic error. And we can deal with that and try to make an adjustment for it over the course of a few measurements. This type of margin recipe for the standard way of doing things has been supported by numerous other investigators, and it indicates that the random error, as I said, has a smaller impact on margins and thus on the normal tissue dose. And not only is reducing and eliminating the systematic error most important, we have to also include the residual uncertainty in estimation of those systematic errors. It's also critical. That should be folded into whatever residual margin that we want to leave. How do we deal with these residual uncertainties? Well, one way I think that most people are comfortable with, just traditionally, is there's some sort of online or offline correction. You see something's wrong, and you try to make it better by putting it in the right place. Another way might be margin adjustment. What did you use that margin recipe, and that margin recipe was for a large population of patients. Now you might learn something about the patient that you're treating that might lead you to believe that you could change that margin for that patient. Or you could use some sort of a dose-based evaluation. You could see the effect that the uncertainties that you're measuring on that patient have on the dose distribution that you think the patient's really going to get. One way to do this that we've looked at is using motion convolution to aid in the treatment planning. At each iteration of the plotting, for instance, you could include a motion convolution in the dose calculation prior to displaying the dose or prior to reporting the dose. I'll show you what that means in just a minute. The resulting dose distribution then would reflect an estimate of the influence of the random setup variation on the doses, and it would the potentially significant difference will be seen between the normal tissue doses near the target. So it should show how well you actually think you're covering the target volume, but it also should give you a better estimate of what the normal tissue doses are right next to the target. And that works sort of like this. You have a treatment plan that you set up with a static dose distribution. You can convolve that with a probability distribution that includes the random setup uncertainties for that patient, and you generate an average outcome. Essentially, it's a blurred out dose distribution, which takes into account some sort of idea that you have of how the patient's going to be randomly set up over time. And you can see, as you expect, that if you look at this average dose distribution minus the original one, which you don't actually see here, that you see differences in these high dose gradient regions. It's essentially blurred out the dose distribution. Now, the two good things about this, as I said, is one is you can actually see whether this target volume is covered the way you wanted it to be once you've smeared out the dose, but you also have a better estimate of the normal tissues that are next to it. You've got an idea of what the dose they might receive over the course of the treatment. Now, one would say, well, then a good idea might be to just use that in the planning process itself. And indeed, you can do some studies and show that if you use the traditional plan with a PTV and then calculate the dose, including the motion, and compare that to where you started out with using the dose convolution to begin with, you can get away with using a smaller aperture or a smaller treatment margin. And there's been several studies that have shown this, that if you take into account the motion to begin with, you can reduce the size of the volume. So you can do a geometric compensation or dose compensation to take into account what you know about the patient. These doses were all calculated using the actual random variations through a course of treatment. And you can see that compared to the original plan, we can actually reduce the dose by taking into account these adjustments. These are not substantial increases. This is the normal tissue dose in this case. But we also assured ourselves in the process that the target was covered correctly, which is maybe the more important thing. The normal tissue doses don't change all that much, although they are better with this technique. Now, of course, we can expand that. We can go into including the deformation in the dose calculation itself. And you've heard several talks at this meeting, and there will be many more about this, about how to do this calculation, taking into account how the volumes expand and distort going from one state of breathing to another, and then you try to add these all up and score them on one of the data sets. And this is just an illustration of this. This is the original treatment plan dose calculation, a little bit blurry here. The dose calculated at a modeled inhale phase, at a mid-ventilation phase, and an exhale phase. You just simply can, if you have this information, you have these data sets, you can calculate the dose in all of these, and then sum them up on one of the dose distribution data sets, and you can get an idea of what the summed dose distribution would look like. Well, one thing that you see is that, again, you see that this is sort of blurred out. And so, again, you're better off if you can start to get away from the general concepts of PTVs and ITVs. I mean, there's always going to be some residual PTV, but get to the idea of actual planning on an average tumor position or a tumor position including the motion in the dose calculations, and you can get away with treating a smaller volume of normal tissue in order to get adequate tumor coverage if you take this into account a priori, other than trying to use a margin rule of some sort. Again, the normal tissue dose, it's more impressive on the preview. In the previous slide, again, there's a modest gain and also the lung normal tissue. But the lung is a large volume, so that small high-dose region that you saw gets washed out over the whole total volume of the other lung also. Well, how can we come to grips with some of these PTVs and these planning risk volumes and setup variations? Well, I think everything is sort of easy in these cases where things are well separated, where we have some sort of an area that we want to treat. It's well separated from the organ at risk, even if we include a margin in both of them. I mean, we can do treatment planning in that situation, and we don't run into too much trouble. The trouble comes when these things overlap, when this planning risk volume might overlap with something in the target volume. And I think this is when all of these rules with margins and things really start to fall apart, because then you have to make a compromise from one thing to the other. And I think you're better off trying to include the motion in the dose calculations themselves. Then you can see the effects and not have to try and say, I want to pick this line or this line, when neither one of them really exists in the patient. They're only a convenience that exists in the treatment room for you to try and guarantee something. You're trying to guarantee that this CTV is inside of this PTV most of the time. One way we've tried to make these things more robust, again, this has just been one instance. All I've shown you so far was a way to calculate the effects of the motion on the dose distribution itself. That has done nothing to assure you that any of these treatment plans are robust to the changes that you've seen. One approach that we've tried to take to this is called this multiple instances of geometry approximation. And what this simply means is to simultaneously optimize plans to multiple instances of the patient geometry with the goal of optimizing plans all at the same time. So instead of having one set of data that we're using in the optimization process, we'll have several. And that would look something like this in a two-dimensional sense. So if you had an idea of where the target volume was and where the patient surface was, one instance of it might be the CT scan that you originally had. Another instance would be the whole thing displaced a certain amount in a certain direction. And you can use multiple instances of this plus your knowledge of how the patient's moving and the 3D distribution of the patient in order to set up different instances of the anatomy. Then you score all the dose back on one of the instances of the anatomy with weighting functions that tells you the probability that you've supplied, which might show the probability of it being in those different positions. What this is going to do for an IMRT type of scheme is it's going to generate beamlets that are robust to these changes, because it has to score on these different instances of the anatomy, or it has to adjust the beamlet pattern in these different instances of the anatomy in order to score back on the original dose function. And one example of this was a head and neck case that we did. We were looking at parotid sparing, and we were interested in looking at what the effects might be on the optic nerve if we for these different planning scenarios. And we see that all these cases, the CTV was covered well. But in these cases where we did a PTV type of margin, we couldn't avoid the optic nerve because the PTV overlapped the optic nerve in all these cases. And so no matter what you do, you're not going to be able to if you try to spare one parotid or both parotids, you're still not going to be able to do it very well if it's going to overlap the part of the PTV overlap the optic nerve. If we do a planning risk volume based things didn't change very much at all. But by using this multiple instances of the anatomy approach, we could end up getting a substantial reduction in a large volume of the optic nerve. Now again, since I also try to look at endpoints and dose effects, I have to point out that if it's only the maximum dose that were important in this case, there may not have been a great savings. But certainly if there's any type of basis of volume, that would have been better. Now, that, I would contend, is at least a little bit on the side of robustness, because now it's taking into account what I might know about the patient. Or, no, I didn't say patient. I said patient, but I didn't mean patient, because I don't know what that first patient's going to do on the first time I see them. All I know is the information that I got from what I told you at the beginning that I've studied for my population of patients. So I had to base all of those either blurring kernels that I used in the dose convolution calculation, or the weighting factors that I used for those multiple instances of the geometry, based on my knowledge of our population of patients. So they're population-based numbers. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is the same as using that number for a PTV. I mean, it's easier to even to think about it if you're just using it as a PTV margin. It potentially penalizes patients who exhibit exceptionally large variation in position or motion. The PTV might not be big enough, and you might have inadequate target volume coverage. it also penalizes a substantial proportion of patients with less uncertainty in their position. the margin might be too big, or my assumption about how they move might have been too big, and I'm actually treating more tissue than I need to because that patient is a good actor as opposed to a bad actor. Okay, so smaller margins would mean lesser risk for treatment toxicity. Seems to have lost my mouse. Okay. So one approach that we've had to try is to try and pick out individual patients from the population, and this is the work that we published recently. And it takes advantage of both what we know about the population of patients together with a set of measurements that you can start to take on individual patients. So you use a population-based prior distribution. That means that we have an idea of how our population of patients act, and we know the mean and standard deviation of that deviation, of that distribution. And we can take mid-course measurements to determine a patient-specific posterior distribution by Bayesian inference. We're going to combine the measurements we've made on this individual patient with the population and slowly approach, in some cases, and more rapidly in other cases, an individual determination of their mean and standard deviation. This is the way that the formula looks. I don't expect you to read all this. Basically, there's the posterior distribution, meaning what's going to happen now from the rest of the time, which takes into account the population part and also some normalization factors in the individual measurements. This, if you do this assuming a day-to-day variation satisfy independent and identically distributed conditions, and if you can, the easiest way to approximate this in a 1D sense is with the mean and standard deviations that can be described by a normal gamma distribution, then you can update this successfully with every measurement you make on the patient, and you can get this a highly patient-specific distribution. Well, what does that look like? It looks sort of like this. These blue dots, which you may be able to see, are the individual patient measurements. Now, this patient actually had a seven millimeter standard deviation, or systematic setup error, and a 3 millimeter random setup error. The population of patients that was assumed has a zero millimeter systematic error, because we assume that we're going to correct for them all, and it has a 7.5 millimeter random error. And you can see that our estimate of both the mean comes very rapidly. We can see that the systematic error is determined after maybe 3 or 4, up to 5 at the most, measurements. We can determine the systematic offset. And the random error takes longer to generate, but it eventually starts going down to about the 3 millimeter standard deviation. So we can get ideas about individual patients. So how would we use that type of information? Well, one way, if you were doing it in a simple case, you would just say, I'm going to use a different margin. I'm going to adapt the margin. So one way you might want to use it in a robust way, I would encourage you to see this poster by Ken G and other authors, is to use something like the MEGA population-based thing and then make adjustments as you get information. The individualized distribution can then be fed back into the treatment planning system, and you can track with tracking of delivery outcomes, and you can replan when some of the objectives are triggered. You put the individual data into the daily data in, and you can see when things are going to change. This is a model predictive control type of scenario. The way this would look like, if you have an original distribution that you want to do something to, let's concentrate just on the CTV coverage here, you can set up a bound on that CTV coverage and then monitor the accumulated dose for certain fractions. When one of those terms comes below the limit, you do a replanning. Again, not just replanning, but replanning with your new knowledge of what that individual's setup distribution is. Then things might go along well for another few treatments until, in this case, again, it's below the thing. This would invoke a second replanning in order to try and restore the objectives of what you were trying to do. Again, now with a new second refined approximation or better estimate yet of what this patient's random and systematic setup uncertainty are, and then include, as you can see in this case, that patient settled down for all the rest of the fractions to the point where then the GTB is in the zone that we originally set up for the GTB, with not compromising very much the zones of the other areas. So instead of ending up with this very bad result for the target volume, we end up with something close to or within acceptable range of what we wanted in the first place. So these population models, I think, while helpful, show significant variations that may compromise individual patient care. Statistical tools can aid early and continuous refinement of individual patient characteristics, and the trade-off exists at which the benefit perceived by online guidance may not outweigh the cost. That's something I didn't exactly get here to, but you may do a lot of work for a little bit of gain. That's something you need to consider. Dose-based assessment diverges from the geometric margin models, which are often pessimistic on volume needed to treat. You treat more than you need to if you just rely on geometry alone and don't look at the dose. Robust optimization methods improve trade-offs of target and normal tissue dose and may further benefit from refined individual patient models as the treatment progresses. Thank you.